everybody. Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I am your host, Philip Drew, Administrator, and our guest today is Dr. Alan Bean. He is President of the Drug Policy Forum of Texas and Executive Director of the Friends of Justice, Tulia. He's a former Baptist minister and author, and is now working on the forthcoming book, Taking Out the Trash in Tulia. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bean.
Good to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you on the show today. Ladies and gentlemen, last week I was not here doing my show live because I took the weekend off to go to College Station for the Texas State Libertarian Convention. And while I was there, I saw a speech that Dr. Bean gave about events in Tulia. Hopefully, most of you know the story, at least in part. In 1999, 46 people were arrested on the word of one undercover informant. And Dr. Alan Bean is part of the Friends of Justice, which fought to get most of them, if not all of them, out of prison, and is an expert in the matter. And it was actually 1 year ago Wednesday, I believe, correct, Dr. Bean, that the Tulia defendants were released from prison?
That's right, 16th of June, 2003.
And from this morning's newspaper, in fact, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram says they're going to get millions of dollars for what's happened to them. So I guess that ought to whet the appetite a little bit. And I wonder, for our audience who don't really know the story, can you kind of give us a short overall sort of retelling for those who are not familiar?
Well, giving a short retelling isn't easy, but basically what happened was that early in 1998, an undercover cop named Tom Coleman was hired by the Panhandle Narcotics Task Force and Swisher County, which is a little panhandle county between Lubbock and Amarillo, to do a undercover narcotics operation. I think originally it was probably planned to be just a few months, but eventually it ended up becoming an 18-month operation where Tom Coleman would come to town two or three times a week. Sometimes he'd work at the sale barn, haying or shoveling hay, well, whatever they do at the sale barn, which is a cattle auction outside of town. And he basically hung around in the African-American community here in Tulia, getting to know people. He won the trust of an older man named Elijah Kelly. Everybody called him Man Kelly. Man Kelly was an alcoholic at the time. I guess he is now off the bottle, but at that time he was very much on it. And he was working at the sale barn, even though he was not really at the peak of his form. He didn't really have much choice if he didn't have any retirement. And Tom Coleman, who was sort of a ponytailed, looked like sort of your basic white trash drifter, befriended Man Kelly, and eventually through him was able to win the trust of some of the young men, almost all of them completely destitute, generally unemployed or only semi-employed, largely uneducated black men in Tulia. And at the end of the 18-month period, he had allegedly made over 100 controlled buys of mostly, almost all of them were for powdered cocaine, which kind of raised the eyebrows of street savvy people that I've talked to, because that is a rich man's drug. The kind of people that Tom Coleman was messing with in Tulia almost always used the much cheaper crack cocaine, and so which is sold in little rocks rather than in powder form, little pellets, really. And so all of these people were arrested on the morning of January 23rd, 1999. Probably several dozen police officers from various jurisdictions throughout the panhandle descended on Tulia, and they did these early morning sweeps, dragged everybody into jail half-dressed in their underwear, and it would have been very easy to have taken them into a garage that they have for that purpose, so their dignity could have been maintained, but the television cameras were rolling, and I think there was a definite desire to humiliate and degrade the defendants as much as possible, to make them look as guilty as possible, and to sort of enhance the impression of guilt. And so that was the first that anybody really knew about this thing. And
That's where you got the title for your book, Taking Out the Trash.
That's right.
The newspaper headlines, right?
there was an editorial a couple weeks after the sting where the editor basically referred to the people as trash and said, we're going to clear our streets of garbage. He referred to them as a cancer on the body of the town of Tulia, and that we're going to have a little chemotherapy behind bars. He used very harsh language, and that was really what kind of drew my attention to the fact that there was something wrong here. At that time, my family was attending the Baptist church here in town, the Southern Baptist Church, probably the more upscale of the two Southern Baptist churches in town, and we were attending a church that included almost all of the movers and shakers in the community. All of these people were professionals, managers at some of the local agribusinesses, school teachers, business owners, things like that. And we were just having a little sharing time before the class began, and I said, you know, Dad, I read this editorial in this week's Tulia Sentinel, and I said, I got to tell you, I was upset by it because I've always believed that we were supposed to maintain the presumption of innocence until people were proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And this guy, I said, really violated that impression because, you know, he was calling them scumbags and he was saying they were all guilty. He wasn't calling them accused drug dealers or alleged drug dealers. You know, he basically was assuming their guilt, and I said I didn't think that was appropriate. One fellow across the table from me got all red in the face, and you could see the veins in his neck tightening. And he said, they are drug dealers. They're all guilty and they're all going to jail. And at that point, I knew there was something wrong. A little later, another fellow in the class who was the manager of one of the agribusinesses in town took me aside and said, well, you got to understand that this is something we had to do because these young black males were just getting out of control. You know, they're all really good athletes, and they think they can do their drugs and mess around with our girls, and we just had to do something about it. We just had to.
Oh, nice. I wonder if that was allowed in evidence at trial, huh?
Oh, no. The odd thing was that the first guy who had made who had growled at me about them all being guilty and they're all going to jail ended up being a jury foreman a few months later
in one of
the trials. And, you know, I mean, he had to swear before he could even be on the jury that he could be objective, that he could maintain the presumption of innocence. And obviously, most of that was just a myth. I mean, it didn't exist. These people were in a position where they had to prove their innocence or they were going to be convicted.
Well, and you said from the beginning that they were dehumanized. They took away their humanity and said they were trash and garbage and dirt on the street to be cleaned. And you know, once you take somebody's humanity away, now you can violate their rights all you want.
That's right.
And now, how does race play into this? Because if the media that I read is correct, 39 out of the 46 were blacks, and it was 61% of the black folks in the town of Tulia. Is that right?
Well, it was 61% of the young black males. And that figure was something that I came up with after doing a lot of research and going through. The nice thing about Thule is that it's so small, and the black community is so small, that you can basically account for every single person. It was 50% of the adult black males in the community, about 16% of the black population overall. But when you look at just the young black males, it was 61% of them got picked up, almost everybody. And with the young women, it was more like 35%. So they basically did a clean sweep, and they knew what they were doing, and they got the ones that had the reputations in town or were related to people who did. And since the community is quite close-knit, the jurors, who were almost exclusively white and who didn't really have any intimate knowledge of any of the people except those that perhaps had been football stars, just sort of, you know, they fit the profile. And somebody gets up as a defendant, and the jury just kind of looks at him and says, yeah, well, his clothes don't fit very well, and he needs a haircut, and he doesn't sit up, doesn't make eye contact, his posture isn't as good as it might be. He fits the profile. Let's see if he can prove his innocence.
Well, the law says that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt someone's guilt, and you say that from the moment the trial started that they had to prove their innocence?
What I'm saying is that there's a big difference between theory and actuality. And if a person is considered to be, and this isn't just in Tulia, but in most places, if a person seems to be upstanding, successful, well-groomed, articulate, educated, and the kind of person that you're not afraid of, that you wouldn't mind meeting in a dark parking lot after dark, then generally the presumption of innocence works overtime. I think people who fit the profile I just mentioned, you really do have to fit to prove a person like that guilty. The same thing is true with a lot of African Americans or Hispanic defendants. If they are affluent, and especially, which follows from the affluence, if they can afford a good legal representation. But in the state of Texas, if you're poor and black, and to a slightly lesser extent if you're poorer than Latino, you're probably going to get a court-appointed attorney. Now, you might get lucky and find somebody who's really going to fight for you, but in most cases, the court-appointed attorneys, the only way they can make any money is to take a plea bargain offer from the district attorney to the client, say, I think you ought to take this, and then sign the paperwork and go home. If they do that, then they can make enough to keep their office going. If they invest any kind of investigation or effort in the process, then their wages start to decline considerably to the point where they're down to burger flipping wages and basically working pro bono if they really take it seriously. And we did have some attorneys in Tulia who took their work very seriously and went the second mile for their clients. But most of those who went to trial got the first kind of attorney. The defense attorneys walked into the room very unprepared. And that's just another signal, I think, to the jury that this person, we're just going through the motions here. Because often, you can even tell just from reading some of the court transcripts, the defense attorneys really did not believe in the innocence of their clients, even though the evidence was so ambiguous. And there really wasn't any physical evidence except a little baggie of powder, white powder, and the only thing tying that little baggie to the defendant was the word of Tom Coleman. So everything hinged on Coleman, and that really is what got me involved. I wrote a letter to the editor just shortly after the first round of trials saying, am I correct to believe that everything is hinging on this one guy, and we don't know anything about him? We don't know if he can be trusted or not.
Well, you know, he works for the state, and that's good enough.
That's right. And that's one of the things that you really noticed in the trials, was that Coleman's credibility was bolstered by Sheriff Larry Stewart, who was very popular in town. He leads the singing down at the Church of Christ. Everybody thought he was a nice, pious guy. And so they would... And Stewart got, you know, was quoted in the local papers as saying that Tom Coleman was a man of integrity and professionalism, and that really had an impact on people. They thought, well, if Larry Stewart believes this guy, he must be believable.
Well, and the appellate judge who ended up dismissing all this, Judge Chapman, he said basically the exact opposite and said, after hearing Coleman's testimony, that this guy is completely unbelievable, and then the next day dismissed all the charges, right?
Yes, but that was after hearing Tom Coleman subjected to the cross-examination of some of the best litigators in the country, particularly a fellow named Mitch Zamoff, who had been a federal prosecutor in Philadelphia for many years. This guy is slick. He's very, very strategic. He's like a skilled fighter who just sort of jabs and jabs and jabs and sets up the hook with the jab. And finally, he just wears his person down and then lowers the boom.
That's kind of skipping to the end here. I just want to make the point that the appellate judge...
The point is that when you saw a real attorney armed with real evidence and solid argument, articulately stated, and compared that to the kind of performances that we saw earlier, the difference was frightening. And so it really shows you that the kind of justice that you get from an American courtroom is correlates with the amount of money that you have in your pocket to buy an attorney or to buy the services of an attorney.
Well, I want to find out how all these people got convicted in the first place. I think you said at your speech last weekend that once they convicted the first guy, who everybody knew was absolutely as innocent as can be, that everybody started pleading.
That's right.
And taking the compromise.
Right.
So who was that first guy, and how did this innocent man get convicted on the first round?
Okay. Well, Joe Moore was a big illiterate hog farmer who had been he had often been called the mayor of Blacktown. He was Tulia had a little shanty town. Everybody in the black community called it the Flats. The technical name for it was the Sunset Edition, and most white people had other names for it when they weren't being so polite. And Joe Moore was an entrepreneur. I mean, he was he ran a couple of bootleg bars out in the Flats, which although Swisher County is dry, the Flats existed across the tracks as a sort of a community unto itself. It had no police protection, no police presence. There were only a couple of faucets to bring water. There was no sewer system. There were no public services. And generally, the police officers would not go across the tracks through the Flats except unless there was a fight. They might come and pick up somebody after everything had settled down. If there was a stabbing, they might come the next morning and pick up the body. But this community was basically left to itself, and Joe Moore sort of became one of the sources of stability in there because he was a big guy and because he was good at talking people down, and because he was good at making money. He made money bootlegging, he made money gambling. There was a lot of gambling that went on, card playing of one kind or another. They'd gamble over dominoes, almost anything. And on Friday night, hundreds and hundreds of people from the Texas Panhandle, most of them African-American, would descend on this little raggedy community west of Tulia to have a good time, and Joe sort of made the most of that. He'd bring in bootleg booze from the nearby Catholic community of Nazareth, just over the Castro County line, and he sort of had a reputation. And during the agricultural season, at various points, he'd get a bunch of old trucks, and he'd have hay hauling crews. He'd organize cotton chopping crews, cotton picking crews. Whatever the agricultural industry needed, whatever the farmers of the area needed, he would provide the field labor that was a vital part of Swisher County agriculture back then. So he had a really strong reputation in the black community as a guy who could lend you a few dollars, a guy who could set you up with a job, a guy who would stop a fight if things got a little out of hand. And basically somebody that you could look to for help in various situations. In the white community, unfortunately, he probably just had the reputation as being a bootlegger who probably, when drugs like crack cocaine and marijuana arrived in Swisher County in the 80s, everybody in police, in law enforcement, just assumed that he probably was a drug dealer as well. And so that was Joe's reputation. Unfortunately for Joe, the people who knew him the best and could really evaluate his character were all black. Many of these people had seen Tom Coleman try to sell Joe Moore drugs, and Joe, who had been to prison previously on bogus drug charges, basically took Tom Coleman apart and ran him off his property and with very impolite language and basically said, if you come back and try to talk to me about selling drugs, that's the last person you're ever going to talk to. And so people knew that Joe Moore had figured Tom Coleman for an undercover agent. He was very street savvy, Joe Moore was. And he saw Tom Coleman coming a mile away, and everybody in the black community knew that. And so that is what scared everybody. They thought, they convicted this guy, and we know he's innocent, and there's nothing the rest of us can do, so we might as well just take the best plea offer we can and make the best. The surprising thing is that after Joe was sentenced to 90 years in prison for allegedly selling Tom Coleman powdered cocaine, seven other people went to trial, which I think shows you that's a very high percentage. Usually only about 5% of these cases, these drug cases, ever make it into a court. In Thule, the percentage was much higher than that.
And that's just because they all knew that it was all so bogus that maybe my trial will be the one to blow the lid off this thing? And
yeah, well, a lot of them, you know, they were very offended. Particularly, they were offended at having been charged with selling powdered cocaine, when a lot of them, although some of them had addiction issues, but they were addicted to crack cocaine. They'd never seen powder. They'd never been in the kind of social circles where powder cocaine would be used, because you have to have a pretty good cash flow to sustain a powder habit. And most of these guys just weren't in that league at all. And that really bothered them, that they were being accused of selling a drug that they had never even seen before in their lives. But it didn't really matter what the facts were. Most of the cases were very perfunctory, very short. They followed the same pattern. They'd bring in the officer who received the evidence from Tom Coleman, who put it in a little evidence locker in Amarillo, and he'd say, "Yeah, I got this from Tom Coleman." And then they'd bring in the chemist who said, "Yeah, I tested it, and it was tested positive for cocaine." He was never asked how strong this stuff was. And most of it was so weak it couldn't get a jackrabbit high. And so that was a problem, you know, why are these drugs so weak? But that was something that defense attorneys were starting to talk to each other about, but it never came up in court. And when anybody tried to introduce embarrassing facts about Tom Coleman's background, which were gradually coming to the surface, the judge would not let them into the courtroom. And so juries were kept deaf, dumb, and blind through these trials, didn't have a clue who they were listening to when Tom Coleman was speaking, and they just convicted one after. Because you have to understand the dynamics. All of the authority figures in their world, the judge, the district attorney, the sheriff, all of these public officials from Amarillo, were lining up on the side of the undercover cop and saying, "We believe this guy." And so it was almost a who are we to doubt these people's judgment situation. I don't think most of the jurors ever really sat down and said, "Now let's take a look at this evidence and see if we can prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt." It was just sort of everybody else says he's guilty. And unless we have strong evidence of guilt, we might as well go along with the program. And that's, I think, one of the things that I've always known intellectually, but that I really was able to experience in my gut, and that is the fact that most people, most intelligent, functional members of society, when push comes to shove, are not really capable of independent judgment in an important matter. And that's scary when you consider that the jury system hinges on the ability of citizens to do that.
Yeah, I mean, the standard is supposedly beyond a reasonable doubt, not whatever's your best guess.
That's right.
You think you believe it because of your respect for the high and mighty judge in his black robe.
Right.
And speaking of the high and mighty judge, this guy who was excluding all the evidence mm-hmm. about what a scumbag this cop was, Tom Coleman, who is this judge, and is he part of the judiciary branch or part of the executive branch? Isn't it his job to protect the accused?
Yeah.
Overzealous prosecution by the executive?
Well, you know, the judge's primary role is to make sure that the defendant gets justice, and that nobody steps out of line, that everybody plays by the rules. They're supposed to keep order in the courtroom. They're supposed to know the evidentiary rules of the state of Texas and apply them in an even-handed manner. Judge Ed Self was the judge who presided over 6 out of the 8 trials. There was another judge who was also part of the process, but I only mention Self because he was the one that was presiding at Joe Moore's trial. And I think Self sort of set the tone. He isn't mean person. He's not a hateful person. I don't think he had any particular desire to see a bunch of black people convicted. But he's an efficiency expert. He wants to clear his docket. He wants to get rid of cases as possible, as much as possible. And I think he's the kind of judge who likes plea bargains because then we have as few trials as possible. We don't have to spend money on them. There's a lot of scheduling. And
so what you're saying is he's not interested in justice at all. He's just interested in himself.
Right. He's an efficiency expert. He wants to grease the wheels of justice, not in favor of the defendant, but in favor of making things as simple and straightforward and cost effective as possible. And so he just naturally, and most of the judges who preside in the state of Texas are former prosecutors. So they tend to have a pro-prosecution bias. And especially when the defendant is accused of a sex crime or a crime involving drugs, then the question is, well, what if this guy's innocent? I mean, what if this guy's guilty? What if he really did it, but the state doesn't have sufficient proof? Or what if the proof or evidence that's being offered by the state is so ambiguous that you aren't really sure whether you can believe it or not? If you decide to acquit, to say this person is not guilty on the basis of insufficient evidence, you might be putting a dangerous drug dealer or a predator back on the street. And we don't want to do that. So there's an inclination, I think, to give even weak evidence the benefit of the doubt and just sort of go with it.
Well, for my sake, I would say that it's better to have a predator on the loose than a predator state that can just go around convicting whoever they want, whether they did it or not. Now,
yeah.
I probably shared with you my anecdote about the assistant district attorney from Harris County, Houston, who told me that the attitude among all the assistant DAs, of course except her, but all the rest of them say, well, if he's really innocent, he'll get out on appeal. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really matter if we go ahead and prosecute an innocent guy. If the cops say he did it, that's good enough for us.
Yeah, and one of the things that I've also realized, I'm speaking as a layman here, I am not an attorney, I've never been to law school, but I have learned a great deal about the criminal justice system, not the theory of it, but the way it actually works in my part of the country, and I think the way it works throughout the state of Texas. And that is that once a person is convicted, it is very, very difficult to reverse that conviction. The Texas Court of Appeals does not question the jury's rendering of a verdict. If the jury looks at the evidence and seems to think that it's acceptable for a guilty verdict, the Court of Appeals is not going to question that unless their decision is bizarre, unless it's completely contrary to reason. And in Tulia, that was not really the case. I mean, there wasn't sufficient evidence to convict. But once the guilty verdict is rendered, then you basically have to prove innocence from that point on. It is not just a de facto thing earlier I said that the juries in Swisher County were requiring the defendants to prove their innocence. But it's formal. I mean, that's the way the rules are written. Once you are convicted, the only thing that's probably going to get you out is some kind of a procedural problem. If on appeal, it can be demonstrated that the prosecution didn't do their job right, or if a judge made a wrong call, or if something was not done properly, and it was really, really serious, then you may get a new sentencing phase, or you might get a new trial. But in the absence of something like that, just the fact that the evidence was not sufficient to convict is probably not going to do you a lot of good. And I'm not even sure, I think that most prosecutors aren't aware at how the number of cases that are reversed by the Court of Criminal Appeals in Texas has been steadily declining, to the point where now they uphold the jury verdict almost as a rubber stamp unless there's something egregious that's wrong with the case.
Well, and that just proves that our prosecutors are doing a better and better job, right? Or that the judges are not doing as good of one anymore.
Terry McEachern, the district attorney who prosecuted the cases in Tulia, has a 95% conviction rate. So that should give you some idea of what a defense attorney is up against. And defense attorneys tend to get defeated. But as I said earlier, there was one gentleman named Paul Holloway who regrettably ended up pleading all of his clients out rather than take them to trial because he just really thought it was a hopeless thing and that he would have, that his responsibility was to work in the best interest of his clients, and he felt that was to get them the best plea bargain he possibly could. But anyway, he drove to Cochran County, which is just west of Lubbock, which is where Tom Coleman worked in law enforcement prior to coming to Tulia. And he asked some questions and dug some things up and talked to people on the phone. And he discovered that Tom Coleman had left Cochran County owing $7,000 in unpaid bills to a variety of local banks and businesses and merchants. He also found out that Tom Coleman, right in the middle of the Tulia sting, had been accused of stealing gas, putting state gas into his private vehicle illegally, and that in order to get those charges dropped, or he had basically his attorney had worked out a deal whereby if he would pay off those outstanding debts to the local people in Morton, Texas, that the theft charge would be dropped. He was never found innocent of that charge. It was just dropped in order to facilitate the paying of the bills.
I read in the New York Lawyer that he was a former member of the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, that allegation has been made by a former wife, Carol Barnett. Coleman has always denied that, but who knows? I mean, it would certainly fit the profile of Coleman. He's a very marginal character. The funny thing about Tom Coleman is that in many ways he is similar to the kind of people that he victimized. He's not mentally retarded by any means, but he's a very slow learner. He got his GED by the skin of his teeth. It's the worst possible grade you can make and still pass. He dropped out of high school. He does not present well in the courtroom. He's very inarticulate. He rambles all over the place, stutters, starts sentences over three or four times before he finally gets traction. He will answer a question with another question. He's always looking a little bit quizzical and confused. He's probably one of the most disorganized people that ever walked the face of the earth. And when it comes to money, he's absolutely hopeless. And so when you delve into his background or read a deposition in which he's being asked questions about his various financial dealings, his marriages, his professional history, you start to realize that this guy just doesn't have a clue what's going on. He's just sort of bouncing from day to day, just trying to make it. And he's desperately in need of a job in law enforcement. Coleman's father had been a very successful Texas Ranger, and he always wanted to kind of emulate that history, but he just didn't have the chops for it. And he also had very strong impulses, and so he was always getting into trouble with people and embarrassing himself and just stepping over the line and having to leave. So every job in law enforcement he had, he was always leaving in the dead of night and just leaving all these unpaid bills and messy relationships behind him. And
it was this man's word that convicted 46 people without a shred of any other evidence whatsoever.
That's right. And so, but he was, his persona that was presented in court was very carefully manicured. And any information that was at all derogatory about Coleman was kept out of the courtroom. Whereas for the defendant, anything they'd ever done, any prior conviction, any scrape with the law, could be brought up by the state attorney during the guilt-innocence phase of the trial unless the defendant chose not to testify. And so almost, I don't think any of them testify that I can remember. And that really creates a very negative impression on a jury. you know, a juror looked at it and said, well, gee, if I had done something, if I was innocent, I'd want to get up and defend myself. Why isn't he doing it? He must have something to hide. And so these trials almost always unfold with the star witness getting up and being, his testimony is bolstered by all of these authority figures. Nothing negative is allowed into the courtroom that would detract from this glowing image that is being presented. Whereas the defendant just sort of sits there like a lamb to the slaughter, completely passive, completely silent, does not defend himself or herself. And the jury is left with one story, the story that the guy told. And most people are not capable of doing the job for the defense attorney and saying, well, wait a minute. And the defense attorney, on the other hand, is put in a position where his only, it's usually a he, his only strategy is to attack the veracity of the undercover cop. And in the state of Texas, that's a very dicey strategy because people
especially
respect,
when the judge won't let you bring any evidence
right.
of what a loser he is.
All you can do is say, sir, you are a lying SOB. This never happened. And that doesn't go over very well with juries because unless you can say, this didn't happen for the following five reasons. You can't just make the bare allegation and have it have any impact whatsoever. But unless you really go after the veracity of a guy like Tom Coleman, you're dead. Because if you let his story stand unchallenged, it's going to sway the jury every time.
This is the Weekend Interview Show. We're talking with Dr. Alan Bean. He's the president of the Drug Policy Forum of Texas and executive director of Friends of Justice. Talking about the disaster caused by the state up in little town of Tulia between Lubbock and Amarillo, somewhere up in the Panhandle. And, wow, what an astounding story. You know, I was searching through your website in the past few days, researching for this, and I came across, it was, forgive me, because I don't think it was exactly an in-depth enough description of this case for me to really understand exactly what was going on, but something about a woman named Michelle Williams who
mm-hmm.
told them that her name was Michelle Williams and they were looking for a Miss White, and they went ahead and arrested her and put her in prison for 3 years anyway, even though they basically admitted that they had the wrong person?
Well, I don't really know if they ever admitted that. That was always her story, but Michelle took a plea bargain for obvious reasons. And but when she was arrested, Tom Coleman came to the house where she was living with her husband, Ricky White, and her stepson, Donnie Wayne Smith, was asleep in another part of the house. He was arrested a little bit later, but they just came for her, and Tom Coleman came in and he said, Michelle, where are you? Where are you at? And she said, I'm Michelle. And of course, Coleman had this weird mask on because there are
because
various.
He's dressed up like a terrorist because he's a drug task force guy.
Right. There's various explanations why he had the mask on. None of them very convincing. But anyway, and finally, the chief of police who was in on the bust and a couple of other local cops said, "Yeah, that's Michelle Williams." So he pulls off his mask and says, "Huh, you changed up on me there." Well, I think probably what happened was that he had never met Michelle Williams. He had, but a lot of the young women in Tulia would give somebody else's name if they were interacting with somebody they thought might be an undercover agent or what have you. And so somehow or other, Tom Coleman latched onto the name Michelle Williams and thought that he had made a transaction with her, whereas in fact she had never met this guy. And this was something that really lit a fire under Michelle. I mean, I don't think it could be demonstrated that nobody in Tulia, black or Hispanic or Anglo, sold drugs to Tom Coleman. I mean, you don't spend 18 months in a town that's this poor and where people are as desperate as they are here and not convince somebody to sell you something. My guess is, several people probably did sell him crack cocaine, and he turned in powder cases because he had rung up those debts in Cochran County that he didn't have any money. His mother supposedly had lent him money to pay off those debts, but he had to pay her back, and he was really only grossing about $1,300 a month, which when you've got the kind of appetite the guy like Coleman has isn't going to go very far. So he was always trying to pad, I think there's a theory among attorneys that I think is valid that he was turning in, that he was buying crack cocaine from mostly from crack addicts who were selling him little rocks of it and often smoking it with them, according to their testimony, so that they could, you know, get high. I mean, these people were very desperate, and then Coleman would smoke the evidence up with them, and then he would turn in, he would manufacture a little baggie of powder that just had a touch of just enough actual cocaine in it to test positive in the lab, and he would simply submit the evidence. And I think he probably got more and more brazen as time went on. Towards the end, my guess is that he was probably just fabricating cases on people left and right, because it was so easy, and he began to realize that nobody was paying attention to him. He had no corroboration. He had no supervision. Nobody was watching him do what he did, and he could do anything, and everybody was going to believe him. And when you realize, especially as a very simple kind of person who is really bereft of any kind of moral compass, you realize that you can get away with anything, what's to stop you? You know, the sky's the limit. And that is almost always the case in narcotics work. To some extent or other, the only controlling factor on your work is your own sense of integrity, which in the cases of many police officers takes them pretty far. But in the case of a guy like Coleman, who is basically walking around without a conscience, it doesn't take him anywhere at all. As soon as he realizes what he can get away with and that there aren't any limits on him, he'll just do anything he wants.
So and how much time did Michelle Williams spend in jail, even though she was the wrong Michelle?
Right. She was in prison for about 2 years, during which time her children suffered horribly. And some of them did remarkably well. It's like you'd expect in any family. There's always one kid that seems to bear the burden for the whole family, and some of those, and not just in Michelle's family, but in many families in Tulia, some of these kids have really gone off the rails because of what they were exposed to. Some of them have stood up remarkably and have gone on to college and what have you. So, you know, it's a real potpourri, a real mix of stories. But the general profile of the kids who saw their parents wrongfully convicted in Tulia is exceedingly negative. These kids have not adapted well. A lot of them are angry. They don't feel that law enforcement or the criminal justice system is there to protect and serve them. They feel that they are victimized.
Of course it's not.
And, you know, and the, unfortunately, tragically, a lot of them, not having the perspective of an adult, they say, well, you know, if they're going to accuse me of it anyway, I might as well do it, you know. And that just adds to their vulnerability. But what the thing that I have written, you asked me earlier if this was primarily about race. And it is about race, but I don't think it's the racism of law enforcement particularly, as law enforcement simply reflecting the racism that is endemic within American society. I don't think people tend to be as racist when they're dealing with the Bill Cosbys and Martin Luther Kings and Rosa Parks of this world. I'm talking about white people. They look at those people and they say, I wouldn't necessarily want my kid marrying somebody like that, but, you know, they sure look good and they speak well, and I wouldn't mind hiring somebody like that. I wouldn't mind having an office next to somebody like that at work. But when you look at the person who is uneducated, the person who lives in a dysfunctional family, the person who may not be successful in school, the person who seems not to be able to adapt to the workforce, can't get any, if they graduate from high school, it's not with a full degree, they can't make it to college, they can't leave the little town or the inner city neighborhood that they were raised in, they seem to be stuck in a rut, and are very susceptible to the lure of the streets. The people who fit that profile, whether they be black, white, or indifferent, as Friends of Justice President Thelma Johnson likes to say, they are really at risk. Not only are they at risk once they get into the courtroom, but they are so much in need of money just to survive that when a person like Coleman enters their world flashing $20 bills and asking for this or for that, buying them hamburgers, buying them a beer, buying them whatever, can you know, giving them rides to work like you did with Matt Kelly. It's very, very easy for them to be lulled into a world where they think, well, this man is giving me, you know, he's giving me money, he's helping me out, he really cares about me, and I don't like drugs, and I don't know where to get them, but I know who does. So if he's going to give me $20, I'll go to so-and-so who's got a brother who I know is dealing crack, and I'll get him what he wants, and I'll give it to him. And he'll give me that $20 bill, and that will get me through the day. You know, people who are living hand-to-mouth, moment-to-moment like that are almost infinitely vulnerable to narcotics task forces, and that is precisely the kind of people they prey on. So the kind of people that we ought to be developing programs for, that we ought to be working overtime to get these people into educational opportunities that are appropriate to their needs. We ought to be trying to get them jobs. We ought to be addressing, in many cases, their mental issues, because a lot of them are mentally ill. We need to be trying to ask ourselves how we can give them a leg up and out of what are often deplorable living conditions. Instead of that, we're trying to incarcerate them. We're luring them into a trap and then slamming the prison door shut for 20, 30, 40 years. And it's obscene, you know. And that is what that's the conclusion I've come to in Tulia, that even if everybody was guilty, and I know a lot of them weren't, and the evidence against nobody was sufficient for a conviction, but even if it had been, even if Tom Coleman had made airtight cases on every one of these people, Tulia drug sting would have been an unmitigated disaster for everybody involved, including law enforcement, including the white people who were on the juries, including the black victims. It didn't do anything for anybody. It certainly did not get drugs off the street. Tom Coleman himself has admitted that the people that were picked up, that if he got any real drug dealers, they were replaced almost immediately by other people. That people are still doing drugs in Tulia as much as they ever were. And so you start to realize that the whole war on drugs is completely incapable of stemming the flow of drugs, of affecting the availability of drugs, of changing patterns of usage of drugs, legal or illegal, in our society. The only thing it's good at is locking up poor, defenseless people. And that's all it's doing. And if you realize the impact, the negative impact that kind of incarceration, mass incarceration, has in the families of these nonviolent victims, it's devastating. It doesn't just impact the person that goes to prison negatively. It impacts their children, their siblings, everybody in their world is violated by this. It's devastating, and especially if you live in a family where it's happening to your brother, it's happening to your uncle, it's happening to your nephew, it's happening to your son, and eventually it happens to you. Everybody you know is going down on drug charges. There are black families in the inner city, in places like Harris County, where families are absolutely, can't say decimated, because that's 1 out of 10. I mean, you're talking about black males, 4 out of 10 young black men in the state of Texas are in the system in one way or another, prison, jail, parole, or probation. And when you go into some of the most needy neighborhoods, that's 7 or 8 out of 10 that are involved in the system in some way. And that just undermines the social unit, the family. It just eats away at the fabric of society.
It just makes matters worse.
That's right. And so having realized that, right, and so, you know, my appreciation of some of those dynamics has grown exponentially over the last 3 years, and it's just changed the whole way that I look at America's war on drugs.
Well, and if you say, if, as you say, 2/5 of young black men in Texas are involved in the system one way or another, that really shows that this kind of thing that happened in Tulia happens all the time.
That's right.
So the question is it the only reason that this one made the news and these people ended up getting justice is just because there were so many of them all at once, and that's why it made such a big story in the news? I imagine there are people busted one at a time who are sitting innocent in cages all over Texas right now.
All right, sure. I mean, there are neighborhoods in Harris County where 46 black guys get picked up every day. You know, I'm talking about fairly big neighborhoods. In Tulia, if, say, 4 or 5 people got picked up, I don't think it probably would have been enough to catch my interest. There were probably four or five of us who early on decided that this was not going to stand, that this was so unjust that we were going to dedicate our lives to bringing it down.
Well, who were those four or five?
Well, there was a farmer named Gary Gardner, who sort of an ex-farmer, really. He, like most farmers in Swisher County, threw in the towel long ago, although he still has his land and his machinery. He had been in a lawsuit with the school board over drug testing policy. And so he was kind of attuned to what was going on and felt that the drug sting was conducted to demonstrate that Thule had a drug problem. So he got involved. My father-in-law, Charles Kiker, and his wife, Patricia, they were retired Baptist ministers who had just moved to town just before the drug sting went down. My wife and myself. One of the fathers of one of the defendants, a fellow named Freddie Brookins Sr., who watched his son get sentenced to 20 years, almost certainly innocent, he got involved when he saw some of us starting to write letters to the editor. You know, he called us up and we got together. And then there was Thelma Johnson, who is Joe Moore, the first person who got convicted, his best friend. And companion, and they're very, very close now. She sort of keeps him going and handles his medications and, you know, tries to keep him eating healthy and what have you. And Thelma was sort of the matriarch of the black community, and we hooked up with her really early on. And so that's sort of the nucleus of the people who are fighting this thing. And we added a lot of the people. We've probably taken half the... Well, probably I'd say at one time or another we've taken 60 or 70 people from the affected community throughout Texas, sometimes to Washington, D.C. or New York City or all over the place, but mostly in the state of Texas. We've been to Austin repeatedly to lobby with the legislature.
What are the Thule bills? I read that you guys had gotten some bills passed
right.
to stop this from happening again. What were those?
Well, the Thule bills were largely, we have the American Civil Liberties Union under the leadership of Will Harrell to thank for them. But these, Will called me up just before the last trial of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar White in September of 2000 and said, you know, I just read this story by Nate Blakeslee in the Texas Observer, and, you know, are these things still going on? I said, come on up. So Will and... Jeff Frazier, his associate at that point, came up, and they were so offended by what happened that they organized a civil lawsuit, but also started asking how they could draft legislation that would try to ensure that the kind of travesty that unfolded in Thule could not be repeated elsewhere. And the key to that was the requirements that narcotics undercover agents be able to corroborate their testimony. They weren't able to get that passed for law officers, but they were able to get it passed for confidential informants. And that led directly to the unraveling of the Dallas sheetrock scandal, where dozens and dozens of mostly Hispanic men who were Mexican American, who were recently in the country and didn't have any fluency in English, were roped into bogus charges of selling powdered cocaine that turned out to be pool chalk. And a lot of these people had taken plea bargains for exactly the same reason that people in Thule did, because, you know, it was like they were offered their freedom or a short sentence and told that if they didn't take the deal, they were going to go to prison for, you know, decades.
How many people was that? I remember reading about the sheetrock scandal.
Oh, boy. I think it's close to 80. I had the figure in my head at one time, but I've lost it. But it was absolutely bizarre. And so that whole thing unraveled and has become an abiding issue that still is not settled. It's still being investigated in the city of Dallas. And we have discovered, working together with groups like the ACLU and the NAACP and other interested parties throughout Texas, that these things are unfolding everywhere throughout the state of Texas and across the nation. It's just that nobody often pays any attention. But people are starting to pay attention. And so I think that bodes well for the future.
We're almost out of time here, Dr. Bean, but I need to ask you, I read that Perry pardoned 35 people, and I wonder why not the other 11? Are there some that are still in prison now? Or?
Well, some of them were never convicted for one reason or other. Two of them had the charges dropped against them, Tawny Michelle White in particular, because she was able to prove conclusively that she was in Oklahoma City at the time of the alleged deal with Coleman.
Oh, and that's the one that Michelle Williams was mistaken for, right? The one that
could
was
be.
In Oklahoma City.
It could,
great,
be.
Great.
Landis and Mandis Barrow, I just got a Father's Day card from Mandis today, are still incarcerated because they were on probation at the time, and rather than taking very shaky cases to court, they just revoked their probation. There's a fellow named Daniel Oliveris, who I think is still incarcerated in Potter County, which is Amarillo, because the people who were convicted in Amarillo were not part of the pardon. There was another woman who fit that category, and little things like that. So it was a very technical thing. It only applied to people who were convicted in Swisher County. And so, you know, that's the reason. One fellow, Eddie Cordona, one of the Hispanic defendants, died before all of this unraveled. And so, you know, that's the reason the numbers are the way they are.
All right, everybody. Dr. Alan Bean, he's the president of the Drug Policy Forum of Texas and executive director of Friends of Justice, Tulia. How about you give us some websites where people can read about the Tulia case?
Okay. Well, probably the best place to go would be to the Media Awareness Project. And if you just type in, do a Google search and put capital M-A-P, comma, Tulia, you will go immediately to their web page. And they've kept and have on file almost every story that was ever done. Or you could go to our www.fojtulia.org, I believe is the it's a link, and you will find our website, which also has a link to the Media Awareness Project, and you can learn everything you'd ever want to know about the Tulia drug sting.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show today, Dr. Bean.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Philip. It's been a pleasure talking to you.